Thanks.
Steve
Allen. I'll be running along now.
When you started The Tonight Show, television was really young.
Yeah, so was
I. Yeah, well, was it easier to take big risks then? Because the stakes weren't as high for anybody, right?
No, stakes were about 49 cents a pound, as a matter of fact, at that time. But all seriousness aside, folks, it was easier because there wasn't yet the hysteria about ratings that there is now. Of course, the late night shows have always been somewhat protected from that. No late night show ever has a big rating, at least compared to, you know, primetime ratings. So you're not under the gun if you, you know, don't get a 26 share or something. But I always took risks, you know, no matter when I was on the air, so it didn't really affect in any different way the way I performed.
How did you get psyched for a live show? Is there something that you would do to...
Well, there was no alternative. It's like saying, how do you get psyched to being born with one leg? You know, if you never had two, then one is not that big a drag. If you had two and then at 27 lost one of them, wow, that's a very bad scene. So if we had started television with tape and suddenly said, hey, we lost all our tape, go on the air live in 8 minutes, everybody would have panicked. But we were all born live, you know. You get out of bed in the morning live, you're not on tape. So to me, it was no different from just existing, except that there were cameras in front of me.
I grew up with the Steve Allen Show and really loved it. And there's a couple of things that I'm not sure I made up or not.
You probably did.
Fern.
Well, of course, that's been in the dictionary for a long time. I actually picked that word up because Louis and I are friends, and Louis and I just used it as a double talk word. It has no meaning or whatever. Sometimes people thought it meant something, you know, like a part of your body or whatever. How's your fern? It did not. It just was like saying, how's your whatchamacallit?
So I really didn't make that up. I mean, obviously you made that up.
It is conceivable really that we might have created it independently, shall we say.
How about schmock?
That, yes, I'm afraid that's another of my dubious distinctions. It's strange, you know, when you work all your life to leave an important, significant body of thought and life and work behind you, and on your tombstone they put schmock. That comes from a story told me one night, just as I was about to walk on the air, by Bobby Rosengarten. Pardon me. Bobby is Dick Cavett's conductor of recent years, and he was the drummer on the original Tonight Show. Doc Severinsen was in the band, and a lot of those guys have been around for that long. But Bobby's a very funny fellow, as well as being a fine drummer. Typical musician's sense of humor. And unfortunately, I really cannot tell on the air what the story was. It's not that it's that vile. In fact, a lot of war stuff is happening on the air every day now. But I choose, nevertheless, not to tell it. It's, I'll use the word dummy. It's about these two guys in the clothing business, very rich. And one guy says, you know, I've had everything, I've done everything, I've had every experience in the world, and I think the only thing that I'd like to do now is to go to Africa and get a safari and a lot of guys with spears and guns and a few elephants and do that whole safari scene. And the other guy says, don't be a dummy, except he didn't say dummy. He said a word that sounds like schmuck. And the story goes on for 20 minutes. And at the end of the story, the fellow's friends' predictions have been borne out because the safari people have mutinied and run away with the elephants, and he has no more food, no more water, and he is, in fact, dying. And as he lies there, breathing his last in the jungle, several big black vultures are up in the air, circling down toward him, going, schmuck, schmuck! And that's where the story comes from.
That's good. I always wanted to know that. How much do you rehearse, like for a live show or for any show that you're doing, the recent ones or the ones from the past?
It depends entirely on what sort of a show it is. For the Meeting of Minds show, that scripted talk show we do for PBS, we rehearse each show for 3 weeks. If it's a talk show, I don't rehearse at all. At least not the talk part of it. If there's a sketch or something, you might rehearse that a little bit before you go on. For the kinds of comedy specials I was doing last year for NBC and for the big show just before that, that was usually a one-week rehearsal, which is a standard for, as you know, in the television variety comedy business. Everybody, if you're going on Sunday night, you start rehearsing on Monday. You rehearse a few hours each day, and it's at the end of the week you have a big hit on your hands. Sometimes.
Another question I've always wondered about, you know, from the old Steve Allen show was how you all came up with the man on the street idea.
I brought that idea in which was not an exercise in originality at all. The Man on the Street has been a journalistic staple, as you know, since my childhood. It may have gone even back before that, and I was born, I'm now 59 years old, so 59 years ago. The newspaper editor sends somebody out with a question of the day, what do you think of, you know, the invasion of Poland or whatever? And they take a photographer and they ask four or five citizens that question and they get their pictures and their opinion. So I was just doing a takeoff of that old journalistic cliche.
It was very funny and everybody had a persona on it, a very strange persona.
Yes, the original threesome, we decided not to use the four or five that you find in a paper, but just hold it down to three different interviews. The original ones were Louis Nye as Gordon Hathaway, the sort of Madison Avenue dignified sort of gentleman. In those days, the term Madison Avenue itself was considered somehow comic. There were lots of jokes and movies and about men in gray flannel suits, and there was the humor of the cliches of the advertising language, such as, well, let's run it up the flagpole and see who salutes it. We'll throw it at the wall and see if any of it sticks, you know, that kind of talk. So anyway, we made Louis a Madison Avenue-type guy called Gordon Hathaway, although oddly enough, as the months passed, we forgot about Madison Avenue and he was just himself. Then there was Tom Poston, who developed his own characterization as the man who could not remember his own name, sort of a Stan Laurel-ish sort of character, forgetful and dopey and funny. Then there was little Don Knotts, the nervous guy, and that, too, was Don's own characterization. He had been on The Tonight Show, which I had done before, the comedy series, and he had two monologues, each about 6 or 7 minutes long, and he was nervous in both of them. The premise of one was he was just an executive or somebody worked at a TV station, and one night the weatherman didn't show up, and he had to be rushing at the last moment to do a live weather report, and he knew nothing about weather either. So he was nervous from the challenge of that task. And the other, he was at a medical convention or a pharmaceutical convention, I guess it was, and he was from one of the main drug companies. He was introducing a new sleeping pill, and somehow or other he had to demonstrate the pill or something. So he was so funny in those routines that we just dropped that character into the Man on the Street. And after about 3 weeks of that, the whole nation was talking about or repeating the little exchange between us. He would be quivering noticeably on the screen, and I would say, are you nervous? And quick as a wink, he'd say, nope.
Another thing you used to do would be to read rock lyrics. Like, I remember you reading of Get a Job, and that really stuck with me. And I always wanted to know if you liked rock and roll or not at that time and how your feelings have changed, if at all.
Well, it's a little like saying, do you like music? Certainly I like music, and certainly I like rock and roll, but I also reserve the right to point out that there is lousy music and there is lousy rock and roll, along with all the good stuff. So much for the generality. But that actually started back about 1948. I've been doing comedy, well, almost all my life, come to think of it. But about 1948, I began doing that routine on the radio, and there had then, rock had not hit as a national phenomenon at that point, although there was rhythm and blues, a black musical form. But it didn't have to be rock. In other words, it simply had to be an innocuous lyric. And there was, back about 1948, a really dumb, giant hit. It was in the top 10. And it was called Love Somebody. I just happen to remember that. And the reason I remember it is that that's all about all there was to the lyric. The lyric went, love somebody, yes, I do. Love somebody, yes, I do. Love somebody, yes, I do. Love somebody, and it must be you. Pretty dumb lyric. So I discovered that the idea of doing those lyrics against a sort of a classical chamber music sort of background, as if it was a poetry reading, would get screams. And, of course, when rock came along, the quality went even further into the basement so far as general coherence and dignity of thought and so forth is concerned. And some of the biggest hits were great. In the last year or so, I've done Hot Stuff. Baby, I want some hot stuff. You know, it really sounds like it's coming from a dodo when you say the words without the proper music. So it gets laughs.
Has network censorship changed much?
I often wonder if there is any anymore. If, considering what they're letting on, I hate to think of what they must be forbidding. I think television has gotten too dirty, so I guess that means I'm for a little more censorship than I see. That doesn't mean censorship of everything across the board, up 17%. It means I think that certain things that I do see on television ought not to be on television. However, I am only me. I'm not running the world, you know.
Can you do another number for us?
Mm-hmm. Number six. See how easily I did that? I can also do it on pencil, but nobody could see it. Wait a minute. I'm drinking tea. That's why I'm saying wait a minute. I know I'm drinking tea, and you know I'm drinking tea, but the people listening don't know, so I have to tell them. I used to work in radio, and you have to tell people a lot in radio.
Did you like working in radio?
Yeah, I love radio. I still do.
Do you do radio anymore, aside from guesting?
Other than that, at the moment, I don't do a regular show, but I get interviewed a lot on radio, and in Los Angeles, I'm on somebody's program or other every few weeks. So it's great fun. Here's a pretty song I wrote about 25 years ago. It's called Spring in Maine. Carolyn Lee.
Would you sing the lyric?
Oh, all right. I'll loosen my vest by the authority invested in me by the vest I'm wearing and open my collar and let's see how my voice sounds today. No, seriously, folks. Another spring is here. But where to go this year? I remember spring in Maine, the gusts of rain, that country lane, and you. I remember fragrant pines that bore the signs of Valentine's. We drew how you kissed me and how we laughed those windy afternoons racing on the dunes like a pair of loons. I remember, forget her words and they're so beautiful. I remember going back again and I recall the pain of coming back another year to find that springtime in the state of Maine was mainly a state of mind. Beautiful words.
And well done. That sounded really good. If you're just joining us, Steve Allen is my guest, and the occasion for his visit today is the publication of his new book, Funny People, which is about comedians who he knows and he's worked with, and we'll be talking about some of those comedians a little later. In, I guess it was the 1950s when you recorded a session with Jack Kerouac,
mm-hmm.
that is a very hard-to-find album now, but I've had the opportunity to hear it, and it's a wonderful session. Did you know Kerouac at that time? Was that the first time you'd gotten together?
Yes, I had just met him before then, and we hung around a little bit at about that point of his life. A fascinating, beautiful guy in many ways. I had gone down to a joint in the Village in New York to see him. I forget who invited me. I think it might have been a record, a guy that was planning to do an album with him or something. And so I went down there, and it was a bad scene at the moment. Very few people in the room knew who he was. There were like 8 people that were, you know, paying the proper sort of attention. The rest were just there, you know, wondering when the jazz was going to start or where was their next drink coming from. And he really wasn't getting respectful attention. So it was kind of embarrassing. On the first set, he just stood up and read his poetry, and I listened, but not many others did. So I talked to him after that. He came over the table. I said, hey, man, I'm not trying to intrude on your thing here, but if it would help at all, you know, to fill in the silences, I'd be glad to lay down a little piano background. And sometimes, even as a comic, I know sometimes it helps to have that in the background, you know. So he said, oh, terrific. So we did it that night, just spontaneously. And then he and the record guy said, listen, we're going to, you know, why don't we put this on tape? He was going to record some stuff anyway, so they asked me to be part of it. So we went to the studio a few days later and laid down the album just as you hear it. I don't think anything was ever edited. I never heard the poems before. I just sat there at the piano and listened to what he was saying and then did a little ad-lib scoring of it. It was interesting to see how he did it. He didn't come really very well prepared. He opened a little beat-up suitcase, the kind you see real poor people, you know, get off a bus with in Cleveland or something, a little beat-up cheap papery suitcase, and he had rolls of paper. He used to write on rolls instead of separate sheets, and a little assorted scraps from spiral notebooks. And he was just picking up poems pretty much at random out of this strange little bag, and then he would read them, and I would play the piano in the background.
It must have been odd to make the music for poems you'd never heard before, but I guess you were...
Yeah,
well, you enjoyed his poetry.
Right. It was there were some little jazz touches, but I didn't even play that much jazz because I didn't want to get a lot of rhythm going and distract from what he was doing. I was just trying to do some scoring and lay down a little mood music, as it's sometimes called.
You don't remember anything you played, do you?
I don't remember a note. You know, it was like over 20 years ago.
You know? Do you have a copy of the session yourself?
At one time, the answer to that was no. We have a system in my office whereby when any of my albums get down to a low number, like we only have 14 left, you know, bells are supposed to go off because every so often somebody borrows one or buys one or I give them away. And believe it or not, we got down to 0 on that one. But since then, I've been able to pick up a replacement copy.
Is it true that you don't know how to read music?
That is true. I don't know how to read the music, read music to play the piano by or from. My reading is like that of... the average 5-year-old who can read out of a reading book, see the dog. So if you show me middle C on a piece of paper, I will be able to say, that is, let me see. Yes, that is C, but obviously it would take me a week to play a song that way, and nobody has that much time. You know? Well, so I play by ear.
A lot of what you play is standards and jazz.
Yeah.
How did you learn what you know? Did you have lessons, and did they discourage you from reading, from learning how to read?
Well, I had lessons, but I was never discouraged from reading. Oddly enough, I was sort of naturally a weak reader. At least, I love to read words. You know, I read a lot of books and things, even as a child. But I was not that good at reading music. I have no idea why. But right from the start, as I was taking little neighborhood piano lessons when I was about 8 or 9, right from the start, some ability to create, to compose, came through. And so I became a composer almost as soon as I got at the instrument. I wasn't writing much but garbage for the first few years, but finally after I was about 12 or so, I began to write in the popular song, you know, structure, and have written about 3 tunes a week ever since then.
Would you play us another one of your tunes?
Sure. I'm just trying to think of something brand new. Before that, I'll play something brand old. This was a theme I originally wrote... as the closing theme of the old Tonight Show. And once in a great while, you still hear it on the show because Doc Severinsen used to love to play it, and once in a while, he still does. It's called Tonight.
Thank you.
pretty.
That is pretty. Steve Allen is my guest. Did you ever sit in with orchestras?
Yeah. I started out in high school and at the college level playing with bands, dance bands, and jazz bands, swing bands. And once in a while over the years I've sat in with, you know, Count Basie or Duke Ellington or whoever was on the show. Did a little jamming when I was making the Benny Goodman movie. And it's fun, you know.
Yeah, the Benny Goodman movie. I've seen that. I think that John Hammond did not want his name used in it because he didn't like the script, and I think he didn't like Benny Goodman at the time very much either.
I understand there is a little misunderstanding, shall we say, between John and Benny. John, by the way, is one of the sweethearts of the world. He's a beautiful man. I don't blame John if he didn't like the script. I didn't think very much of it myself. I was wishing there was a little more humor because every musician who ever worked with Benny has incredibly funny stories to tell. Benny is probably still the greatest clarinet player of all time, but a bit of a goofola on a certain level. He's a real absent-minded professor. You know, the fly is open. He doesn't know where he left his keys. He doesn't remember people's names. You want to hear the great can't-remember-name story? This is true. It's not all that historically funny, but it's funny only because it is true. They had had, by they, I mean Universal, like, searched the bushes for a year to find somebody to play Benny, and they finally hired me. And Benny worked on the picture, and we hung out together, and he knew who I was. I was already well-known from television, from The Tonight Show, blah, blah, blah. So we make the movie, which all finished. It's a big hit. Good or bad, it was a hit. And to promote it, we had Benny on my show. I was doing the old Sunday Night Comedy Show at that time on NBC. So he comes on. He plays something sensational, as always. And then I had to learn the instrument to make the film. So it was set up that we would play a little duet together. I wouldn't play much, but I'd, you know, just ride along with him and fake it a bit. And so there was nothing on the script between the two numbers. I said, there's no reason to put anything down here. I will just say, Benny, that was marvelous. And then you say to me, well, Steve, why don't you, since you learned to play the instrument, why don't you, play a little number with me? And then we just did it. That's all he had to say. So he does his number, applause, applause, applause. I walk in with the clarinet under my arm, and I say, Benny, that was fantastic as always. And he says, thank you. He says, well, Pops, he forgot my name in front of 40 million people, you know. But he did that all the time. It was typical of Benny. So I wanted to get some of that into the picture. And the producers and director, they didn't want that. They said, no, you're already a comedian, and we're afraid if we let you do that, it'll seem like you and not like Benny. You know? Maybe they had a point.
Did either of you worry outside of that about fidelity to real life?
Hmm?
Did you worry about fidelity to real life outside of that?
Not really. Not as if I would have, if I were playing Thomas Jefferson or something, then it would be important. In the case of who cares whether you're true to Benny's life or not, one of the reasons I thought it was a fairly dull movie, except for the music, which is always wonderfully exciting because it was great music, but it was sort of dull as drama because nothing bad ever happened to Benny Goodman. See, in the case of the Eddie Duchin story, that was exciting because poor Eddie Duchin died, which is kind of dramatic. Wasn't too good for him, but it was good for the movie. And in the Glenn Miller story, great drama. He was lost at sea and, God bless Jimmy Stewart and all that stuff. But I didn't have that break. Benny had a great life, and he played terrifically, and he married a millionaire Gentile society woman, and he lived on Park Avenue and in Connecticut, and nothing but good news, So they didn't add up to great drama. But thank goodness the music, as I say, was terrific.
Do you watch it when it comes on TV?
I've seen it about four times over the years. The main reason I keep trying to find out when it's on is I want to make a tape of it. Because Universal won't give you so much as a candy bar without, putting it on their expense account. I've asked. I said, I'll buy one. Let me have a print of the damn thing. And they won't do it, so I'll have to make my own print off the air sometime.
Hmm.
For my grandchildren.
Your new book is about comedians who you've known and worked with.
Funny people, and, yes.
Yeah, it's called Funny People. And when you have comedians on a show that you're doing, is there ever a sense of competition? Because I can imagine two funny people trying to outdo one another, to top one another.
Yeah, I guess that has happened, but never in my experience. I have all the funny guys on because I love to work with them. In the case of this book, I wrote just about funny people that I think are funny. There are a few people in the business that don't break me up, so I didn't write about them. But don't try to make any easy inferences from that because there are about 400 comedians, and I wrote about only 18 in this book. And there are many others who are not there but I think are marvelous. So whenever I've done a comedy show, especially of a prime time sort, I immediately send out for about 12 funny people. I could do a show alone, but for about a week and a half, then people would get sick of that. They'd say, okay, delightful, we love you. Now where's the rest of the show? So right from the start, I give them a big family of funny folks, and I think it's much better that way.
Who do you like who's currently on TV or in the clubs?
I like almost everybody. I've realized fairly late in life that in laughing at about 95% of my professional peers, I am apparently unusual in that regard. It's neither good nor bad, it's just a fact. Most professional comedians, I've discovered, are not all that amused by many of their fellows or brothers or sisters in the trade. The average comic usually has two or three other people he will name when he will say, oh, so-and-so, they're terrific, or I love, you know, Charlie Chaplin or whoever. But they usually don't want to be quoted for the record about 74 other people that they don't laugh at so much. So I don't know why they laugh at so few and I laugh at so many. I guess I'm just easily amused.
Lenny Bruce had been on your show, and I've never either seen the program or seen a tape of it.
Mm-hmm.
But what was he able to say? We have trouble playing his record sometimes. We have to go looking for for the instances in which there's no foul language, as they call it.
He wasn't able to say a great deal. Oddly enough, one thing he did, quote, get away with, end quote, was a routine about glue sniffing. And the reason he was not given any trouble about that is that the world had not yet found out about the dangers of glue sniffing or the practice of sniffing glue to get high. If anybody's now listening to me who's 14 years old, the word is, don't do it, boys and girls. It's very harmful to your brain and not too much great for your nose either. But in any event, some dodos were doing that back in those days. So Lenny had a whole thing about a kid who was borrowing money from his father to buy glue because he told him he was making little balls that would model airplanes, you know. And if anybody at NBC had known what that meant, they wouldn't have let him do that. But he never did any dirty stuff on television. There was, you know, no problem with him that sense at all.
Did you find him easy to get along with?
Oh, yeah. He was a great guy. He was very much as he was on stage, very easy, very hip. It was like talking to a trombone player. You know, he had a real musician's personality. He hung out with jazz guys, and he spoke the authentic jazz man's language. So he was very easygoing, just as the typical musician is easygoing, you know, popular musician.
You mentioned that you were listening to Billy Crystal at one of those comedy clubs, and you started to think that if everybody in the audience had amnesia and one of the comics from a couple of decades ago or more got up and started doing their routine, that probably no one would think it was funny.
Well, it wasn't that they would not think it was funny, but it's that the guy would have trouble, and I think that would apply to maybe 20 or 30 famous comedians, which was my way of seeing that a lot of the new guys, the under 40 group anyway, are very, very funny, and they are. It does not follow at all that because they're not as, let's say, popular or as famous as Bob Hope, that therefore they are not as funny as Bob Hope. You can't make those judgments at all. Sometimes people are very popular, and I'm not talking now about Bob, just as a generality. To be popular is not, as I say, necessarily to be great in any field. Some of the most popular actors, probably the most popular singer of the century was Elvis Presley, but judged only as a singer by blind people, let's say, he was not a very good singer. You know, let's be honest. God love him, but he was not a very good singer. He was a different thing altogether. He was a star. He was a phenomenon. He was a kind of an entertainment freak. And as far as I was concerned, he was a nice guy. I didn't know about him, you know, shooting bullets in the ceiling and all that stuff. It never happened when I was with him. But there's not much success, I mean, not much connection, I should say, between success and talent. If you happen to be talented and successful, that's terrific. That's how it's supposed to be. But there have been a lot of talented people who never made it, and there have been a lot of very minor talents who made it big.
What's it like when you're doing a routine and you feel like you're not really getting the audience? What can you fall back on to help things happen?
That would be a great question to put to 200 comedians and see what patterns of answer you get. In my case, I'm very fortunate because when I do my comedy concerts, well, there are some cases where I do just nothing but comedy, but usually I have the piano to fall back on. I have my songs. I do a routine called that, and then I wrote, you know, with a few of my popular numbers. I sometimes have Jane in the act. I can work with her and do certain kinds of things. Or simply because I am reasonably articulate, I can suddenly turn into either Eric Severide or Art Linkletter before your very eyes, you know. And somehow or other, I get through the hour. But the guys who are really in trouble are those who they have that 7-minute routine about chewing licorice, and if it's bombing, they have to bomb all the way to the end of it. There's no way they can back out of it, you know. And all comedians have suffered those experiences. There are no exceptions to that. Every comic, no matter how great he is, he has bombed.
I've seen a lot of television shows, dramas, where there's a comedian who's either like the main character or a secondary character. Mm-hmm. And there's never a comedian on a movie or a TV show like that who has a pleasant life. Because really, on stage they're very funny, but off stage, they're always miserably depressed, and you feel very sorry for them, basically pathetic characters.
Mm-hmm.
And it always struck me as being a kind of silly stereotype, and one that was just there to make us feel that it's okay, we're not as funny, because really funny people are miserable when they get off stage. But I don't really believe that.
Well, it's a cliche, as you say, but there is the cliches grow out of some measure of truth, which is then distorted or exaggerated or over-refined. But, of course, in the context of drama, no matter what the character does for a living, he will usually be in trouble, because you can't make an audience watch an hour of sweetness and warmth. You know, they will walk out of the theater. So you have to give them rape and incest and headaches and murder and worry and suicide and mayhem of some kind or other, because that's tension and conflict and drama. Therefore, the fact that in most dramas the comedian is sad doesn't matter, because in other dramas the dentist is sad, the psychiatrist is sad, and the history teacher is sad. But now to return to reality, it is the case that comedians as a group are somewhat flakier, underlined somewhat, than just plain fellas or ladies. So and many of them, in fact, some of the funniest, are demonstrably quite unbalanced emotionally and psychologically. I mean, it's a matter of public record. I'm not going to rename the names now, but everybody knows who they are. In a recent issue, or the current issue, depending on when this is heard, of Playboy, there's a long interview with George Carlin in which relatively little attention is paid to his comedy. The man who interviewed him seemed more interested in the fact that he was hung up on cocaine for years. So there's pages and pages about how it is to use cocaine, and pages about how emotionally unstable he was and how, you know, loused up his life was. So there is this pattern in the lives of some funny men and women.
You have a chapter on Andy Kaufman, and you quote David Letterman as saying that sometimes when you look Kaufman in the eyes, you think that somebody else may be driving.
Yeah, Andy is a very interesting case. He functions well, he's successful, he's wealthy, and he's a nice guy. I like him. We hang out a little bit. But I don't think anybody will ever understand where the real Andy Kaufman stops and the whatever begins. Now, it's commonplace to observe that, gosh, I played golf with Woody Allen and he didn't say anything funny for 2 hours, or whoever's name you might mention. So the fact that we comedians aren't always horsing around, I mean, I'm not horsing around right now, I'm just speaking like, you know, anybody. But with Andy, the borderline is not clear. You just don't know when he's putting you on, and I sometimes think he isn't putting anybody on. I sometimes think he believes everything he does. Whereas when Steve Martin plays a jerk, you know what he's doing. He's pretending to be a jerk, and he's certainly not himself. But with Andy, there's nothing quite so clearly defined as that.
Must be very uncomfortable to be around him then.
There are moments, yeah. He doesn't laugh much at jokes. Obviously, on one level, he's got to be some kind of an expert on humor. He knows how he is funny, and he you know, he's been complimentary, say some nice things about me, so he knows what is funny, but he doesn't laugh much. He's not like one of the gang. Usually if five or six comedians get together, they have a great time. They're laughing at each other and topping each other and horsing around like a bunch of high school boys, you know, in a bus going to a football game. But with Andy, it's not like that.
We were talking about what you do when you're bombing. He has whole routines based on
he plans to bomb.
The audience.
Yes, yeah. He plans to bomb. Another interesting bomber is one of the great comic minds, I think, Robin Williams. A lavish comic gift, tremendously creative and inventive. If something happens, you know, if a glass falls off a table, he'll do 40 minutes on it. You know, he really is spontaneous and wonderfully gifted, and yet he's constantly worried that he's bombing. If he didn't get a laugh for 3 seconds, even though he may have gotten screams for the previous 30 minutes, he forgets about it altogether right away and goes into a panic. Now, one of his most brilliant routines, which I quote in the book, is the one where he takes you inside a comedian's mind while the comedian is bombing. And it's like sending orders down, you know, to different rooms in a submarine or something. Attention, boop, boop, or, you know, all hands on deck, that kind of thing. One part of the brain talking to another. It's sheer genius, brilliant comedy.
Steve Allen is my guest if you're just joining us. And right now we're talking about the subject of his new book, Funny People. Can I ask you to do another tune for us?
Got another tune or two? Yeah. Yes. I was monkeying around at the piano just the other night in Los Angeles at home, and I came across something. I played a D minor chord, and something interesting happened with my right hand. Let me see if I can reconstitute it. Come in.
Does it have a name?
No. It has a number. No, it has nothing at the moment. I must have given it some name because I compose, since I don't read music, I obviously don't put it on paper, I compose with tape. And I usually put 15 or 16 tunes on a tape and give them meaningless titles, what we call in the business dummy titles. So it probably has a name like Mashed Potato Soup or something that has, you know, no connection. But so we can file it under M is the point.
A lot of people are almost Freudian about names, going into what composer must have really been thinking based on the names. But I'm sure a lot of composers are like you and just attach a name to it.
I once thought that it would be interesting to find out what were the stories, if any, behind the titling of some famous jazz classics. So I did a clever thing. I prepared a form letter and sent it out to about 20 band leaders and arrangers. I sent one to Stan Kenton and Benny Goodman and Woody Herman, asking, you know, why was one of Woody's great records called Four Brothers? Why did Benny Goodman call one of his things Benji's Bubble and another tune Rachel's Dream? You know, what appear to be meaningless titles. And I got interesting answers. Oddly enough, I don't think I ever wrote the article. But it's a fair question. In most cases, the titles are quite arbitrary and there really isn't much of a story behind it.
There's a joke that Woody Allen told that you retell in your book. The first time, I guess, he was on your show. Would you tell that joke, and then I want to ask you something about it.
All right. I hope I can do justice to it, because in telling jokes or repeating funny lines.
This is actually the joke that I think he was going to tell, and maybe it wasn't even on the air.
Yeah, I think it was censored off our show. Woody appeared on my show back in 1964. This is before the world knew who he was. But he was brilliant even then. He was brilliant even before that, because when he was going to high school in Brooklyn, he was selling jokes to comedians in the business in New York, just, you know, $5 a joke or whatever the price was at the time. And he was also submitting lines to a columnist who would print his lines. Anyway, the joke was that he was talking about his ex-wife, first wife. He said she was, on the way home recently, she was violated. And then the joke was, knowing her, I would assume it was not a moving violation. You know, so he wasn't allowed to do that joke that night, even though it was by then a part of his nightclub act. But now they could show the violation on television, you know, much less do the joke.
So what were the reasons that he couldn't do it? What specifically didn't the censors like about
that? I personally never knew about the act of censorship, but it must have been that somebody had either heard the album or else he maybe auditioned it in the office and somebody said, hey, you're marvelous, but we can't do that joke. That was very common in those days. For all I know, Woody himself might have said, I don't think I should do that joke on television. I don't know. We'd have to ask him. But in those days, you just didn't hear anything the least bit off color on television. You know?
I think that's a joke you probably couldn't do now for very different reasons, because
feminist kind of perspective.
Yeah, well, the idea that somebody should be moving around and getting into the rhythm of a rape is pretty horrifying
exactly.
And not at all funny. And I don't think that would go over.
Yeah,
now.
Right. If you make the thing at all realistic, you're right. It becomes very distasteful for other reasons.
So much humor, American humor, has been based on belittling the comedian's wife. But I guess, right? Isn't that
it's
true?
It's interesting. The reason I laughed is that I do a thing in my act. One of the reasons my act is never the same twice, maybe it should be, but it isn't. And one of the reasons is we pass out question cards to everyone in the room. If there are 1,000 people present, we pass out 1,000 cards. And it just says, do you have a question for Mr. Allen? And from 1,000 people, we'll get back maybe 300 questions. And before I go on, the questions are brought to my dressing room. I quickly look through them and pick out 30 or so that strike me funny at the moment. I walk on and I ad-lib, you know, new lines. And sometimes if an old question comes up, I might do an old line too. But because I'm married to Jane Meadows and because she's well-known and so forth, I get, you know, questions. How did you meet Jane? How's Jane? Where's Jane tonight? How's your Jane? Something about Jane. So originally this was an ad-lib, and now I sometimes repeat it. I said, well, you know, of all the comedians in the business, I'm probably the only one who does not do jokes about his wife. And for a moment, I speak very seriously. I say, Milton Berle can do a joke about his wife or anybody else. And the reason they can is that you don't know their wives, you know. So, and therefore, the jokes do not have to relate to reality at all. The guy's wife in reality may be thin, and he'll do a joke, my wife is so fat that when she sits around the house or whatever, you know. And it's just a joke. It doesn't relate to the real woman. But I said, in my case, my wife is famous. She has as many fans as I do, so I can't do jokes. Also, she's brilliant and talented and lovely. And there's nothing funny in that. It's nice for me, but not funny. And then I say, after they say, isn't that lovely, a lovely man? Then I say, I don't mean she's perfect. And then they realize what's coming. Then I do some jokes about my wife. But they can't be too crazy jokes. They have to be a little bit related to what could be reality, you know.
Did you ever start laughing at your own joke so hard that you couldn't go on?
Yes. In fact, there's a famous instance where I was not really laughing at a joke I had said, but I'm constantly embarrassed by this because it's being reshown on television. Just recently, Dick Clark had a show called Bloopers, you know, outtakes from various shows or films. And back about 57, I was on the air live one night, about 30 or 40 million people watching me, Sunday night, and something suddenly struck me funny, and I could not get hold of myself. So there's me acting like an idiot for about 4 minutes laughing.
Do you remember what that something was?
It had something to do with how I looked. I used to do a character called Big Bill Allen, a sportscaster. It was kind of a takeoff on a sportscaster named Bill Stern, who wore a fedora. Why he wore a fedora, I don't know. So I wore a fedora, and it looked silly. And I hadn't had time to make a quick change from another costume or something. And I put my hat on with no mirror. And when I saw myself on the monitor, something about the hat looked silly and got me laughing. Then a famous comedian then, he's dead now, named Jackie Leonard, Fat Jack Leonard, was standing backstage waiting to go on. So I was eating into his time. He kept yelling at me. The more I was trying to stop, he would louse me up by saying, "Come on already. I only got 3 minutes. You blew two already. Come on there. Get off." You know, the audience couldn't hear him, but I could. So it was just one of those roles. It's the laughing in church syndrome, you know. On that same Dick Clark show with Bloopers, I thought the funniest thing of the evening was Bill Moyers having the same kind of laughing fit, but in the White House at a media conference. And he was, as you know, Lyndon Johnson's press officer. And a marvelous guy, one of the best men in our society. To me, that was much funnier because I do nonsense for a living anyway. So if I break up, who cares? But here was a man in the White House talking about serious matters, and he got the giggles. And that's hysterical because of the ought-notness factor.
Yeah, they're impossible to shake once that happens. And then you realize that you're in a very dangerous situation.
Yeah, you're
and
at
really
a funeral, you're at a hospital, you shouldn't be laughing. And the more you realize you shouldn't, the more helpless you are.
You know, I realized that I grew up with your show and with a lot of other comedy on television, some of it terrific like yours, some of it not so good. But you couldn't have grown up with comedy on television. So comedy in your life when you were growing up probably had a really different place than comedy in my life did, though your parents or your mother anyways was a vaudevillian.
Yes, my mother and father were a vaudeville comedy team. Milton Berle has been kind enough to refer to my mother as the funniest woman in vaudeville, and she may well have been. She was one of the funniest people I've ever met, even funnier just in a room than on stage, and she was marvelous on stage. My comedy is somewhat like hers, at least one aspect of my comedy, the kind that's truly ad-lib and is just based on whatever just happened, whoever walked in the room or what somebody dropped on the floor. Very often, if I do a line, then it sounds like the way my mother used to talk. But there's a great silliness to me, which was never part of my mother's comedy. She was never silly. I don't mean it's great. I mean, there's a lot of it, you know. My whole family, my mother's family, among whom I was raised, were funny, with one exception. There was one square aunt, and all the others were kind of hip and witty, kind of a sarcastic Irish sense of humor. The other night on the NBC magazine show, they paid tribute to a marvelous man, a truly great humorist, in my opinion, although most people don't understand that because he's a sports writer. His name is Jim Murray. He writes for the Los Angeles Times and in syndication. He writes wittier stuff about prize fights and baseball games than most people are doing on this week's comedy shows. Wonderfully witty, and his sense of humor is very Irish. I'm sensitive to that simply because I come from the Irish background. And some of the little things he muttered out of the side of his mouth the other night on that NBC show were typically Irish. A Swede would be funny in another way, but not that way, you know?
What was there an Irish circuit? Well, I guess vaudeville. Because, you know, I'm thinking like the New York Jewish comedians had the Borscht Belt circuit to do their accent.
There was never, in that sense, a sort of an Irish circuit. There was little bits of it. I mean, there were Irish clubs. And in the old days, there were a lot more Irish comics than there are now. Three groups which have given American humor important contributions were, of course, the Jewish, dominant, far and away, and then the Irish and the blacks. And if you ask why that is, you can see a certain common thread in the history of the three groups. Restless submission to dominant authority, more tragedy than whatever the sad norm is. And in each case, the gift of gab helped, you know. The Jews had their way of responding to that. The Irish had a kind of a sarcastic, as I said, side of the mouth, low-level kind of way of muttering little funny insults so the English couldn't hear them or the butcher couldn't hear them or the cop couldn't hear them. I was reading recently something about W.C. Fields. His mother was funny in that way. And when he grew up, what we all know is the W.C. Fields style was actually his mother's style of muttering under her breath little funny lines that were sort of insulting, but the objects of her wrath couldn't hear them, so they weren't cruel, at least.
Can you do another one of your tunes for us?
Well, since 'tis that season, I could play a little Christmas tune. Unfortunately, all I remember is the melody. It's called Christmas Eve, and I remember that it starts out, Christmas Eve. But all you'll get is the tune. The words are gone.
Can I make one small request before you have to leave us? Sure. I'd love to hear you sing again. Can you sing another tune for us?
Yes, I'm willing to. Let me think. What could I sing? I've written so much music that I forget most of the words, but there must be something. Some years ago, I wrote the words and music to the Broadway musical Sophie, based on the life of Sophie Tucker. And every musical, successful or otherwise, must have a love song or two or three. So this is one that... In such a song, you just say, I love you, but you have to say it in as fresh a way as possible. So this is one called, I Love You Today. Good morning, my dear. I love you today. I've said it before, I know. But even so, I love you today. The tree in the meadow, the lark in the bloom, we'll see the lovely fire of my desire for you. Hello there, my friend, I love you today. My heart wants to draw a crowd and sing out loud, I love you today. One life won't be long enough, my love, to convey. But just you wait and see, through all eternity, these words you'll hear from me. I love you today. I realized about halfway through that wasn't my key. But game trooper that I am, I went ahead and screamed like an idiot anyway.
Well, I thought it sounded really good, and I want to thank you, Steve Allen, so much for spending some time with us.
Hey, thank you. It was great to talk to you. I love public radio anyway, and I love the title of your show. It's a great idea. Fresh air.
Great. Thanks a lot. I've really enjoyed it.